So the wheel of life originates when Mahamudgalyayana, this very popular lecturer, became too popular. And people started complaining that they couldn't get in, or that he couldn't do the tours and all that sort of thing that he'd been booked for. And so the Buddha said, look, we need some other method of teaching people about states of existence. And he said, okay, I've decided to invent the wheel of life. And he picked up a handful of rice, and with the rice, he made a pattern on the ground, and he told his personal assistant, whose name was Ananda, he said, could you make us one of these, or get a painter to make us one of these? And he explained exactly how it should be. This is according to the story. The story, by the way, dates back to about 100 BC, so it's quite an early Buddhist story about how the wheel of life originates. I don't know if it's true or not. I don't think it really does go back to the time of the Buddha, but this is what the story says. And so he said, look, I want one of these made, one of these pictures made, and put in the entranceway of every Buddhist monastery. And this shall be a teaching aid. So it was very much a visual teaching aid. And there would be a specialist in each monastery who was specialized in teaching this. And anyone who came to the monastery could get a little lecture if they wanted to on the wheel of life using this teaching aid. And to this day, in the vestibules of Tibetan monasteries, you will always have one of these tankas, a painting of the wheel of life. You'll also find it in other parts of the Buddhist world as well. So this is one, I think, painted in Nepal. So it's a recent painting, but a very nice one, a very nice detailed painting. So I'll show you some close-ups of this in the slideshow. But just get an impression of it. I mean, if you look at this, or this sort of more stylized sketch, I mean, what do you notice, especially if you're not familiar with the Wheel of Life? What sort of things do you spot? Is there anything that sort of interests you there?
The head of the eyes.
Yeah. So the same one you can see here, yes? So there's a head with bulging eyes.
Angry.
Looks very angry, yes. Fangs. Skulls in his hair. His hair is very... He needs a haircut, really, doesn't he? Anything else?
It's very busy.
It's very busy. It's full of all sorts of stuff going on, yeah. What was the other thing?
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
That's
Do you think so?
It's the Buddha, that is.
You spotted the Buddha?
That monster's the Buddha.
Oh, I see. The monster is the Buddha. But there is a Buddha up in the upper right as well, rather rudely pointing.
And there are skulls. I can see
skulls. Skulls in the hair of the monster. Yeah, that holds it. Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a rabbit on the left-hand side.
Yes. Yes. A rabbit in a porthole, sort of thing, apparently, at the top.
That's another.
And someone pointing.
Yes, so that's the Buddha pointing, yes, and you can see the Buddha. There's a difference here. You see there's got the pointing Buddha here, but instead of the rabbit, we've got a Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva of Compassion in this one.
What's the significance of the rabbit?
That may come out as we get to that point. Yes. Okay, so this is the Wheel of Life, and as I say, in a way it's not really a work of art. It's more a teaching aid. So it's a bit like a 5th century BC PowerPoint presentation, really. That's what this is. And I suppose if they'd had better technology, they would have shown you snapshots of it, of different parts of it at different times. So that's what I'm going to try and do later on in the slideshow. That's not my slide. That's right. Yes. So this is shows some of the features of the Wheel of Life. So the turner of the wheel is Yama, the Lord of Death. So that's the monster with the bulging eyes, skulls in his head, and the fangs. So I'll come back to him. Buddha points at moon. Moon symbolizes liberation. We've got some... why a rabbit, though?
And they see a rabbit rather than the face, so we say.
That's right, yes. And then there's the hub of the wheel, the three root delusions. I'm going to go through all this in detail, but just gives you a basic idea. The hub of the wheel, the three root delusions, greed, the pig, hatred, the snake, lust, the cock. Then you've got, it doesn't mention this here, but you've got the bright path and the dark path, the white and black segments. Then you've got the six realms. Can I use one of these? So so you've got the Deva realm. Deva means angels or gods. Literally means shining ones. So that's the realm of the shining ones. Asuras is the jealous gods. Then here you've got the hungry ghosts. You've got the beings in what it calls hell, or the downfall, as it's known in Buddhism. Animals here, and humans. And then round the edge, you've got the 12 links of dependent origination. Yeah. So that's the overall structure of the thing. And I'm going to go through it, I think, in a minute. First of all, I want to give you a little bit more history on it. So this is not a very good one. This is a westernized version of it, just to show you an up-to-date one. I'll show you another up-to-date one later. But you can see the same features are there. The Buddha is pointing to the hare, actually, this, rather than the rabbit. There's the demon, Yama, the lord of death. There's the hub, the cock, the snake, and the pig. There's the bright and the dark segments. There are the six realms. And there's the 12 links of dependent origination around the outside. So it's full of symbols, absolutely crammed full of all sorts of Buddhist teachings. Very, very interesting in that way. Now, this is the oldest wheel of life in the world, and unfortunately it's rather damaged. And it's the only ancient one known from India, which is so tragic, because every monastery would have once had one, but when the Muslims invaded, they were very destructive towards the monasteries in particular, and nothing has survived. But this is from Ajanta, and in Ajanta there are these wonderful cave paintings, and one of the paintings there was of the Wheel of Life, probably around 1500 years old, but very badly damaged. But you can probably see, you can certainly easily see the outer segment of the 12 links. You can see the realms, the segments of the realms there, and that's about all you can see, really. There's not really much sign of a demon holding onto it. And there's various other things going on around it. Now, it spread through the whole Buddhist world, but I found it really difficult to find examples from East Asia, from China, Japan, and so on. This is one from about the year 900, from a place called Dazhou, in China. I don't know very much about this, but you can see it's very different in this case, isn't it? And it's got your 12 links around the outside, these 12 little cameo pictures, but instead of the three animals in the middle, it's got a Buddha in the middle with these rays coming out from him. But you can see the demon of impermanence or death at the top holding the whole wheel. So that's a Chinese example. This is it's a very bad image, but this is the best I could do to give you an impression of a Japanese one. Typical muscular Japanese demon. But they're basically the same thing, the six realms and so on. But what it's lacking here, it doesn't have, whatever it's got around here is not the 12 links. And I'd like to do a bit more research about this, but I know very little about the way the Wheel of Life is used in China and Japan. And of course it's the Tibetan one we're most familiar with, and the Tibetan teaching. And the Wheel of Life was reformed by a very great enlightened Tibetan teacher called Tsongkhapa, who lived in the 1400s. And he actually slightly updated it. In fact, he changed it from five realms to six. And one or two other little changes he made, which he thought would help with it as a teaching aid. But the very interesting thing about it is incredibly variable it is. The basic structure is always there in the Tibetan forms. But I'm going to show you a few now, take you through a few, because every artist does it in his or her own way. They really use it as a... I mean, sometimes they're obviously on something when they're painting it as well. And I mean, this is just such a psychedelic demon, isn't it? So the basics are always there, but the artists have a great time in deciding how to do it. And there are little variations. You can ask me about it if you like. I mean, if you want, you can look out to see if you're an expert, see if you can spot variations.
There's a TARDIS up on the top.
A TARDIS up on the upper left, yes. So that's an interesting one. I'll come back to that. But do you notice something about that? That it's actually got a sort of a ribbon coming down from it. We might see that later as well.
So there are quite a few more hell realms than there are other realms.
There are lots of hell realms there, aren't there, yes. But there are also lots of god realms in this one, that are all stacked on top of each other. And some of them are invisible, so there's maybe more of those. Very nice perky hair in that one. usually wears a tiger skin, the demon. I think they have great fun with the demon, actually. They really seem to enjoy that, the artists.
That one's just got... has it just got five realms?
Yes.
So which is the one that's missing?
So the gods and the jealous gods are sometimes united into one. I mean, the original, the way the Buddha taught it, he didn't divide those. And that's Tsongkhapa who invented that. He said, let's have two, let's give the jealous gods an extra realm of their own, you know, because they're such a nuisance. Might talk a little bit more about that as well. So we're back to six there. It is very busy, isn't it? You know, it's like there's a huge lot going on. Look at what's going on around here. All these extraordinary
so
things.
It's set in a different, it starts in a different place, that one.
You mean the 12 links on the outside?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. So this is the so-called starting point, is the blind man with a stick. But that's usually at the top. But in this case, it's down here. Sometimes the realms are mirror images of each other as well. I mean, I mention this only because if you look them up in books, you might get slightly confused because of the changes.
Doesn't it go the other way at all? Because it only goes clockwise, doesn't it?
No, that's the right... Yeah, it goes ding, ding, ding this way. Yeah, so it goes the same way round.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Where did that one come from?
This is a Tibetan one. But most of them, I just found them on the internet. You know what the internet's like, you sort of find all this stuff lying around. So I don't know the exact provenance of it, but it, apart from the fact that it's from the Tibetan tradition.
So that's a mother giving birth, isn't it? Ignorance? Carnal virtues?
Yes, this is different, isn't it? Yeah, this is usually a monkey, but it seems to be a couple making love. And this is the point of conception. So that's conception there, you see. They often have quite a few images of people making love on them. You'll be glad to know in the Wheel of Life. And this is also really nicely decorated. Look at the canaries up on the top left. Okay, so I'm going to dive into it now. Is that all right? So shall I start going through... I'm sure a lot of you already know some of this, so just sort of tread water while I'm talking, if you like. And I'm very happy, if you want to chip in at any point and ask a question, please feel free to do that. So let's start with the demon. So I find this very interesting. He's holding the whole wheel, as you can see in this one as well. So he's grabbing onto it with his claws, but more than that, he's actually chomping at it. Isn't he? And it reminds me, have you ever seen a small baby, if you give them a very large biscuit, they grab hold of it like this, and they sort of bite into it at the top. So it's a bit like a baby with an enormous biscuit. And he's chomping away at it. And he's said to be the Lord of Death, or the Demon of Impermanence. And he's intended at least to be frightening, with these big bulging eyes and the fangs and the skulls in his hair and all that kind of thing. Do you find it frightening? You don't really.
Only in the cartoon sort of way.
Sort of a cartoon frightening, yeah. What about this one?
Yeah, he's nightmare.
You notice how his eyebrows are on fire.
Is it sort of primordial panic?
Maybe it's primordial panic, but... I mean, in a way, it's sometimes said to be simply impermanence. He's chomping away at everything. Impermanence is chomping away at everything, spinning the wheel round and round so that you're spinning between from one state to another, as we'll see later, in the wheel. But there is another character. He's called Yama. And there's another character in Buddhism called Yamantaka. And Yamantaka means the slayer of death or the defeater of death. And so it's said that death was tamed by this incarnation of the Buddha called Yamantaka, or the wisdom bodhisattva. And so it's said that Yamantaka is no longer a demon, but he's now a goody instead of being a baddie. He's now friendly, because what he's doing all the time is just reminding you that you're never stuck. So actually, although he looks, impermanence looks frightening, when you're losing things, it's frightening. It can be quite unpleasant. But it would be far worse if nothing could change, if everything was stuck. So in the bigger picture of things, the demon is not an enemy, actually. He's a friend. He's just a rather frightening friend, because he tends to chomp everything up and spin everything round. And he just, that's just what he does for a living, you know. So it's only fair that we should let him do so. So if one can make friends with death, this is really valuable, and one's own death as well. In a way, I hope it'll be clear later, but usually, down in the bottom, in the hell realms, he appears again. He's there in the middle there. And he's usually holding up a mirror in the hell realms, is the Lord of Death. And so it's said that death is something that forces you to really look at yourself. And if you take your own death seriously, you have to look at yourself and your life and say, well, what is really important to me? It's not going to last forever. I really have to make good use of this. And of course, if somebody close to you dies, the same thing happens as well. You say, well, I've lost that person. They've moved on. They've moved on to something else. The connection's still there, okay, but nevertheless, you know, I remember this when my father died. It's as if I kept on dreaming of him. The contact was really strong. But of course, every time I woke up, I had the intensely difficult sense that I really had lost him. He really was dead. And this happened maybe, I don't know, maybe 50 times over the couple of years after he died, where I keep thinking he was alive, because I was very close to him. And then I realised, no, he was really dead. So on the one hand, the connection was still there, and I felt, you know, enormous goodwill towards wherever he was now, wherever his continuation of his consciousness was. And I really hoped that would be good, and I hoped we would meet again. But I also knew that we wouldn't meet again in the same form. I knew it would, whatever it would be different. And so I think in a way it's quite valuable to face that, just to face up to that fact. I mean, it's not just, okay, that's a big one, losing your parents, but even just the small losses of life. When a piece of machinery runs out, the batteries run out or something, you know, something like that, or just something that you'd like breaks, you know, it's got to go. Things do not last forever. And each one of those is a really valuable lesson. So I think death is itself valuable.
Fear comes into it a lot as well.
That's right, because it's intrinsically, that sense of losing something precious, especially losing yourself, is the most frightening thing you can think of. And I think that's why he looks so frightening. In a way, he's currently underneath, but he looks frightening.
Or even maybe frightened into a state of monstrousness of himself.
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it, yes. In a way, maybe he's us frightened into monstrousness, yes. That's interesting, yeah. That's mine.
Yeah, I think that somewhere Sam Rasha says, well, I mean, others have said it before, of course, that, yeah, fear of death is underlying, all fear is essentially fear of death. That kind of is the underlying fear. But you mentioned the mirror.
Yes.
He held it up in the mirror in the hell realm. But we can also think of the whole wheel as being a mirror.
Yes, I'm going to come on to that in a minute, actually, yeah, okay. to the wheel as a mirror, yes. Mm. And in fact, it's just that, I mean, according to the ancient Indian pre-Buddhist legend, when you die, you look at yourself in the mirror. And it's not just to do with the hell realm, the hell realm is where that's most frightening, but wherever you end up, wherever you pass through, you have to look at yourself. Death forces you to look at yourself. And I think that, in a way, the prospect of death is also very valuable for doing that, just for saying, let me really look at myself, because this is not, I don't have forever, I can't postpone everything. I've got to live now, actually. I've got to decide what's important now. Okay.
What's the third eye?
Usually the third eye means a deeper spiritual seeing. So if the Lord of Death is looking at you, like you looking at yourself in the mirror, then it's saying he's not just seeing the surface, he's seeing something deeper. So that's probably why he's got the third eye there. So, the hub, the very hub of the wheel. Okay, so yes, the wheel itself is a mirror. So if it was a number of different snapshots, it would be several mirrors. It's as if you look in the mirror and the very first thing you see is in the middle. Then you look again and you see the next circle. Then you look again, you see the next circle, and you look again and you see the next circle. That's what the different circles of the Wheel of Life mean. They're different ways of looking in the mirror at your own life, at yourself. Do you see what I mean? And this is a very valuable way of looking at it, I think. And of course it's traditional, as I say, because indeed Yama does hold up a mirror. So it's clear that the Wheel of Life can be seen as a mirror. So this is the first thing you see when you look in the mirror. And I've got this. This is the one from our own Wheel of Life, just blown up so you can see it more clearly. So what is this? What are you seeing when you look for the first time? It's three animals, yeah, biting each other's tails. The left-hand one, that's fairly clear, isn't it? That is a serpent, a snake. The one at the bottom is meant to be a hog. And the other one is, well, it's sometimes a rooster and it's sometimes a pigeon. In the early Wheel of Life, the one the Buddha described, he says pigeon. And they're biting each other's tails. So in a way, this is looking at your primeval, primordial, basic drives, which we share with the whole animal kingdom. It's looking at those basic drives, and it's saying, when you look at yourself, take notice of that. Remember the fact that, in a way, much of us is still very basic, an animal like that. And so, in its non-judgmental sense, we've got the drive of the pigeon, which is towards its mate. The pigeon is regarded as a bird that, have you ever seen them? You know, in this time of the year, when the males are chasing the females around, you know, they just don't give up, do they? And they're sort of parting out their chest and all that sort of thing. And the females try and get away and have a little meal or something, and they're just being chased the whole time. So there's that sense of longing, that sense of need, that sense of hunger, I suppose, that sense of sexual hunger or any kind of hunger. So that's the pigeon. The snake is the other side to that. The snake represents the tendency to push away. There's more to it than that, because in a way the snake bites back. It's the tendency to fight back, even when it's not necessary to do so. So, you know, if you go for a walk in a place where there are venomous snakes, as you probably know, you have to be very careful, because you step on it. Even though it's a complete accident, you might be dead. Because the snake will strike, and it will strike if it thinks it's under threat. And so this is that basic defensiveness, that very strong offensive defensiveness is what's symbolized by the snake. And what's symbolized by the hog is narrow-mindedness. And the images of a pig rooting around in the undergrowth with these big flappy ears, have you ever seen them? This one doesn't have very big ears, unfortunately, but big flappy ears that almost cover their eyes. So all they can see is what's straight in front of them. And so I'm not saying this is necessarily fair to these particular species of animal, but in a way this is what it represents. Yeah, it represents those basic, the narrow-mindedness, just being interested in what's immediately in front of you, and the longing and the neediness on the one hand, and the defensiveness on the other hand. So those basic drives. And they can come out, they can become, in a way they're okay, we need them. You know, they help. You need to be a bit defensive, you need to know what you want, and sometimes you need to sort of focus down on the immediate situation, you know, and not get too distracted. So that's fair enough. But they turn into greed, hatred and delusion. So they turn into the intense craving where you really feel that you're not complete and you're constantly looking around for something to complete you. That you look to aversion, where you really find there are some elements of your experience, or particularly some other people, that you just wish they weren't there. They're just too inconvenient. And ignorance, where you are, to some extent, deliberately shutting out elements of your life and your experience. So those are the basic drives, and they're circling around, and they're connected together. Because after all, greed can easily turn into aversion. Ignorance can produce both of them. That's why they're biting each other's tails as they go around.
Going around from left to right as well, aren't they, the other way around to what the...
yes. Well, that's true, but on the other hand, this one they're going the other way, so I don't know if there's any significance in that. And in fact...
The slides upside down.
No. No, that slide's not upside down.
Are they always in the same order, who's biting who?
No, they're not actually. I've noticed this. Going through the different wheels of life, there is not consistent. It's not consistent.
You don't have a pig biting your bottom or
something. Yes. Okay, so that's the first look in the wheel. That's what you see the first time. Now the second thing, what's the second thing you see? That is the next ring around here. So you're looking again, you're looking at yourself, remember, here. And what you now see is, in a way, a very primitive, the element of choice in life. But that very basic, rather polarized, black and white sort of choice between either being a good person or being a bad person. And so you have these rather pious people on the left-hand side. They're all praying, that kind of thing's a Buddha at the top there, because of course this is in piousness, is in a Buddhist context here. And then on the right-hand side, you've got a couple of blue demons with their long chains or something, and they've tied some people together, naked people, all tied together and sort of tumbling downwards. And normally, although not in this case, but one of them is white and one of them is black. And it's called the bright path and the dark path in basic Buddhism. Good karma and bad karma. Doing the right thing, doing the wrong thing. But the problem is, it's in a circle. It's circular. So it's not saying that you shouldn't try and be on the right path. Fair enough. That's all right. You know, but don't think that that's the end of the process of learning about life, because actually you'll just tend to swing between them. If you see things too much in terms of being right or being wrong, especially other people, you'll tend to find you're being very judgmental and you're just swinging from one to the other, or circling from one to the other. So that's the second look. The second look at yourself, you will find that, in a way, that judgmental self, that self that wants things to be black and white, that is making a choice all the time. And that's a valuable thing, that possibility of making a choice. And what that leads to is what happens when you have the next look. And this is the most complex part of the whole wheel of life.
Is that eternalism and nihilism?
That's too difficult for me. I don't know. Trust me. I don't know about that. I'm not talking about stuff. I tend to think they're both eternalists. They're both to do with eternalism. But they could be. Maybe the left hand tends to be those people that are really looking for some permanent solution in a way, like a heavenly state. And the right hand is people that just see everything, maybe it's pessimism in a way, seeing everything as being very bleak and meaningless. So there is that. But it's interesting the way they're tied together, isn't it? You know, and naked. I'm sure there's significance in that.
They look like slaves, don't they?
Like slaves, yeah, they're tied up and they're being... It's not even as if they're going down under their own volition. At least they feel as if they're being dragged downwards.
Well, one's being kicked down at the top, isn't it?
Yeah, that one's being kicked, yeah, and kicked in a rather tender spot.
It does make sense, I think, actually, because, I mean, it's to do often with the consequences of these actions. You don't want the negative consequences.
You don't want that, no. But you feel as if you're just tumbling and you can't control it. And then it looks quite a difficult path on the left, doesn't it? You know, you're really having to clamber up from one cloud to another.
So the top, you're totally ebullient, and then you... Yes. Commit an unskillful act and then down everything collapses.
Yes.
You see the experience, no? Yes.
However, however, there is a little gap up here. You see? Up there. So you don't have to keep going round and round in circles.
The escape hatch.
That's the escape hatch, yeah. Okay, so I'm going to start going. The next look is the next circle. This whole circle here. And this is the six realms. So now when you look in the mirror again, and you start to see, what sort of state am I in? What kind of a person am I at the moment? Am I an angelic type person, everything's going really well? Am I in a hellish state where I'm really depressed or really paranoid? Am I a hungry ghost, you know, where there's a strong sense of need? Am I an animal sort of state where I'm just looking at those basic drives? Am I a human where things are balanced, you know, or what? Am I a jealous god? And so that's what you get next, is these different options. And I just want to say something very brief about this, how we do, which is that there are three ways of looking at these, which are all traditional in Buddhism. One way is that they are literally places you might find yourself reborn. So in a way, the basic almost superstitious Buddhist belief is that you might actually find yourself as a ghost. If you live your life in a very, very needy, hungry way, then you might find yourself as a ghost, one of the hungry ghosts, where you can't leave the house where you were brought up. You haunt it because you were so attached to something, or something was really unfinished. So there is that possibility, maybe, that there are literal possibilities for rebirth. But the other two possibilities are that they're types of people. So you can meet a person whose predominant, you know, character is a bit hungry, ghosty. You know, they are rather needy. They're very attention-seeking, for example, or something like that. Sometimes you do meet people like that, don't you? Or you meet people who are very Deva-like, very God-like. You know, everything seems to go well for them in their life, at least for a while. But then the third way of looking at it, which I think is probably the most useful, is that they are states that all of us can pass through. And we probably experience at different times all of those states. And it's quite good to notice what sort of state you're in. If you're in a hungry, ghosty state, you think, I'm just so dissatisfied. I'm switching through the TV channels and I'm sort of making myself a pizza and ringing different people up and texting them. And I don't know. Then you realise, hang on, brother, hungry ghost. You know, and it's really helpful sometimes to notice that you've got yourself a bit stuck in one of the realms. And then, fortunately, there's a way out. And one thing that I'm going to go on to this later, but in each of these there's a Buddha. And there's the Buddha in this particular one. This is the human realm here, and there's a Buddha at the top there in the God realm as well. And so the Buddha sort of gives a little tip. The Buddha can't drag you out. You've got to do it yourself. But the Buddha gives you a hint as to how you get out. I'll talk about that later. Okay, so we've got the realms, we've got the realm of the gods. These are very much shown in traditional Tibetan ways here, which we may not relate to very much. But so they're enjoying themselves. They've got a swimming pool, which is always a nice thing to have, isn't it? This one's quite a weird one. Here they all seem to have villas, but the villas of the realm of the gods are in a row, and they've got a large black dog as well. Yes, and you notice this, you see, this is the realm of the jealous gods, and they're all armed, and this is the wish-fulfilling tree, and its roots are down here, and this chap here, he's got a saw, and he's trying to chop the tree down because he wants the fruits. He doesn't realise by chopping the tree down, which is fruiting in the realm of the gods, he's going to lose the fruits, and this is all to do with karma, of course. So there are the jealous gods again, with their bows and arrows and their spears and so on. And this is the gods are defending. This is to do with ancient Buddhist legends, or even ancient Indian legends, about the fight between the gods and the asuras. Very similar to the Greek legends about the fight between the Titans and the people who lived on Zeus. The same legends you have in Norse mythology as well. This is if the old gods fighting the new gods, and sometimes changing position. But in Buddhism, this was psychologized, and it was said, well, you can be in that state. You can be in a godlike state in the sense that you're powerful, you're confident, you're a talented person, you've got a lot of abilities, but you use them in a very, very competitive way. Do you know anyone like that? Or have you been like that? So you're really going for it. You're going for status, you're going for, you know, the right marriage, or you're going for a good house, you're going for possessions, money, and all that kind of thing, going for political power or whatever.
So the castle.
It could be that this battle between the gods and the archers is what's happening at this very minute in Whitehall. But which is which, though, that's the question. And which has got the elephant?
David Cameron's
the elephant.
Nice to meet you, isn't it?
So that's the jealous gods. So you look in the mirror, you say, am I a jealous god today? You know, am I really battling other people for status of wealth? Or really very useful little question to ask. And then we've got the animals. This is again blown up from here. So you'll see water creatures down here. You'll see lots of herbivores and things. They're sort of wolves of some sort, and they've caught something else, and they're eating it. So the realm of the animals is not recommended, according to Buddhism, it's not recommended to be an animal. It's very good to be nice to animals. It's not that, you know, it's nice to have a good relationship with animals, but if you've got the choice, it's best not to be one. And I mention this because I think some people are quite romantic about animals, and they think, wouldn't it be lovely to be a dolphin, you know, leaping about in the sea, you know? But I mean, actually, is it really what you want? And especially if it is true, as Buddhism says, that animals have got less self-awareness than humans in general, which means that you don't really know what's going on. I mean, sometimes maybe you don't really want to know what's going on because you're being chased by a pack of wolves. But
not all animals are the same, though, are they?
Not all animals are the same. And
there's
some
a hierarchy within animals.
Some animals are definitely more aware than others. But the thing is, from a Buddhist point of view, best not to be an animal. And a human-type animal, it's worth you look in the mirror and say, well, what am I to this morning? You sort of feel, yeah, I'm a bit of an animal this morning, aren't I? You know, wow, I'm eating my breakfast, I can tell. And I'm a bit obsessed just by immediate needs. And so you can be honest about that and say, yeah, that's the animal in me today, isn't it? I'm a bit like, you know, just a bit of a football supporter.
Sorry.
There's no culture, no, that's right.
It's definitely not Darwinian, then, in any way.
It is Darwinian, because you can leap out of the animal realm into the human realm. So you can leave the animal realm and you can evolve. You can evolve. This one, by the way, there are a lot of water animals here, quite interesting looking ones. And this is a naga, which is half human, half snake, which is regarded as a denizen of the animal kingdom. And the naga guards this great treasury, this great storehouse of jewels. And this is a hunter there. So the other problem about being an animal is that you do tend to be butchered by human beings.
Sorry, what was this? What's this one again?
This is the animal realm. Yeah, ignore that down there. This disco down here is something quite different.
Yeah. All right, it's just another thing of the
that's
animal
one of the, yeah, that's another one of the animal realm, yeah, so. Okay, this is what's called the downfall, which is usually translated into English as hell, because it's quite similar in some way to the Christian hell, but of course not permanent. And there's nobody who judges you to send you there. It's just a reflection of your own mental state. So if your mental state is very, very paranoid, if you've been dominated by enormous fury and anger in your life, then it's as if that is like throwing sand into the wind. You throw the sand into the wind with great fury and anger, and what happens quite soon is it all gets blown straight back in your eyes. And in a way, this is what's said. It's said that fury and aversion and hatred will tend to bound back on you quite quickly into you being in a very, very unpleasant state. You'll actually find life quite horrible. If you're dominated by hatred, you'll find life horrible. And this is described by being boiled in cauldrons. Or living up here, these are the cold hells up here, being buried in ice. Or being tormented by goats. And there's another version of it. This shows you Yama's mirror. He's holding his mirror up there.
They seem to go to town with them a lot, don't they, these?
They like well, the artists love it. Yeah, look at this. Look at all the blood pouring out of the cauldron.
So this is telling us more about the artist.
I think it is. Yeah. I think that's telling you quite a lot about what the artist's obsessions are. Yeah, some of them are obsessed by inventing methods of torture. I think.
So we should all really paint our own wheels.
I think that's a very good point. I think to paint your own wheel of life would be a really interesting thing to do. I think. Yeah. And sort of to depict what is my hell realm actually like? What would it look like, you know, if it was objectified? Or my god realm as well. So this is the hungry ghosts. So what tends to happen is that they have these swollen bellies and they have very small mouths. So they're never really satisfied. And they have flames that when they try and eat something, it's a bit like everything turns into vindaloo.
Malnutrition, though, as well.
Yeah, it is malnutrition because they don't get any nourishment.
Oh, yes.
It's as if they cannot be satisfied. And they tend to hang around toilets, according to British tradition, because they think that they are restaurants.
Have
When they reach down to drink water, the water turns to flame. So it's, I think you can imagine, and this is very extreme, I know, but can you know what that's like when you keep thinking that what you're just, you go into a shop and you buy a magazine or something, and you think, oh yeah, this will be all right, but then it's really unsatisfying. Or you eat too much chocolate, you know, and at the end of it you just feel sick. And it's as if something is not being satisfied in you. And so what you think at first is going to be satisfying just turns to something, to its opposite. So it's quite difficult. It's as if you're too hot. I think this is from Flann O'Brien in Third Policeman, I think, or one of those things, where what he says is being in hell, or being, and I think this is more like The Hungry Ghost, is like you're in a sauna, but the sauna is much too hot, but right next to you see this wonderful cool plunge pool. So you dive into the cool plunge pool, but as soon as you're in, it's much too cold. But next to you see this lovely warm sauna. So you dive into the sauna, but as soon as you're in there, it's much too hot. And you spend your whole life doing this, if that makes sense.
In each one of these, there's a Buddha, though. Yeah?
In each one of them, there is a Buddha, yeah. So we can see the Buddha at the top.
And do you explain that in a
particular... I will explain that, yes. Time's going on. So here's the human realm. Ordinary human activities, a house here, people getting on with ploughing land, farming. Here's somebody being very nice to some rather haughty looking monks. Someone going for a walk. Riding a horse. You know. So basically...
Is there a cash point machine?
Yes, there's the cash point machine.
Oh.
So these are rich people looking out from their balcony. So it's ordinary human life. So it's a mixture. The human realm is said to be the best one to be in, even better than being in God, from a Buddhist point of view, because you've got a mixture of experience and you've got some objectivity. All the other realms are subjective. You are self-obsessed. Sometimes everything's wonderful, sometimes everything's horrible, but it's self-obsession. In the human realm, everything is very social. There's a lot of interaction going on between people. And it's a much, much better place to be, and it's said to be the best place from which to gain enlightenment. And here's another rather Lowry-like human realm, which seems to have a zoo in it. Okay, so I mentioned this about what's the best place to be, and this is actually from the Chinese tradition, on the Chinese Wheels of Life. In the different realms, as I'm told, I couldn't find one to show you, but they have different seeds in the realms. And these are good seeds, bad seeds, and Buddha seeds. So the good seeds are your tendency to go up the bright bit. The bad seeds are your tendency to go around down the dark bit. So if you look, you'll see that the gods have got loads and loads of good seeds, and they've got a few Buddha seeds, and they've got no bad seeds. Yeah? So their tendency is to have a good time. The asuras have got lots and lots of bad seeds and a few good seeds. The praetors, lots of bad seeds. Hell, lots of bad seeds. Animals, one or two good seeds, not many. Humans, an exactly equal proportion of all three. But the interesting thing here is, can you see where there's the second biggest number of Buddha seeds? In hell. So if you can't be a human being, the blessed place to get enlightenment from is hell. Because you've got no choice, anyway. It's so awful. You've really got the incentive to do something about it. So if you do find your life really unpleasant, it might be a really good chance for you to really look at the whole life and say, okay, maybe it's time now I really made a big change. So it's difficult. It's really difficult. Because if you're in hell, it's so horrible. You know, if you're really paranoid or really depressed. It's very, very difficult to earn. But it is said that there are quite a few Buddha seeds there.
It's like those kids in the favelas, isn't it? And when we see that, we think that's my idea of hell, you know, searching for a living identity.
Yeah.
But actually, some of them are incredibly motivated and they actually manage to achieve what they want from those places.
Because
they're incredibly motivated to get out.
And the asuras are the worst from the point of view of Buddhahood.
Mm. Yes, because they're so obsessed with what they've got a lot of energy, but they're not using it for... And I think there's some truth in this, actually. There's some truth in this. That people who are very successful and are really going for it, they're the least spiritual people very often in the world.
Well, I think it's just that they think they're making it. If you're in the hell realm or the you know you're in the hell realm, right?
Yeah.
But if you think you're an artist, you think, oh, I've just done a little turn up, I've got to get this, I'm nearly there, I've got to get that last little bit of the tree down and I've made it.
So here are the Buddhas, a bit bigger, just to show you. I'm going to have to be brief, I'm afraid, because it's after 9:15, but, so every realm has a Buddha in it who gives you a tip as to what to do. So, okay, what's the Buddha doing in the Deva realm, the God realm? Playing guitar.
It's a lute.
Well, it's a vinar, to be exact. Let's just say playing guitar, yeah? So, what you have to do if you're in the God realm is listen to the music. Because music has the message of impermanence. And it tells you, this may be good, but it won't last forever. And it's like very poignant, very beautiful music. The gods won't listen to you if you give them a lecture about how they ought to meditate or something. They'll say, why? Everything's fine. What they need to do is listen to music. Because music, they like music. But it has to be this really poignant music in order to persuade them that, hang on a minute, it's not going to last. You know, it's worth actually looking to the future and doing something about it. In the jealous gods, the Buddha, it's difficult to see this, but he's actually got a sword. So you see how he speaks the music, the language they understand. So the jealous gods are fighting, and he says, right. And this is a real sword, but it's the sword of wisdom. So he says, use that incredible power that you've got, but use it to make distinctions. Use it to notice what is really going on, he's saying. So that's the sword of wisdom. And they've all got their own colour, by the way, these Buddhas as well, which I won't go into. In the animal realm, the Buddha is, and you can't see this here I'm afraid, but the Buddha's holding a book because what the animals need is just a little bit of humanity I suppose. They need to have a bit of culture, they need to be aware of something a bit bigger than what's just in front of their overgrown ears. So culture in the human realm. In the hell realm, the Buddha there has, this is a flame here, and in his other hand, he normally holds ointment. So the first thing that the Buddha provides there is just a little bit of respite from the suffering by giving them some, what's that stuff called?
Amrita.
It's ointment. It's usually an ointment. Sometimes amrita, but it's usually ointment that he offers them. So it's a healing balm of some kind, you know. Sort of that BP cream.
Arnica gel.
Arnica gel. Arnica, that's what he offers them, yeah. But and then the flame is like, again, it's what they recognise. They recognise fire and they go, oh no, I'm going to be burnt again. But it's flame that offers light rather than heat. So the Buddha here illuminates the situation. So they're not so totally obsessed with their own predicament. And they can see a bit further. Okay. And then in the hungry ghost realm, the Buddha here offers, this is amrita. So this is something genuinely nourishing. So there are two levels of meaning for this. It could simply be that if you are in a hungry ghost thing, you need to find something in your life, doesn't matter what it is, but which really does genuinely satisfy you, which doesn't just, you know, it's not like just eating too much chocolate. It's something where you feel like, you know, deep communication and deep relationships with people, or maybe artistic expression, something where you feel that is really satisfying. It really is reaching my deepest needs. And the other meaning of the word of the amrita is even bigger than that. It's the amrita of the elixir of enlightenment itself. So it's as if what is really deepest, satisfying on the deepest level, is to actually know what's going on and to develop real compassion yourself. So that's what the Buddha's offering there. It's, they recognise it, they're looking for something nourishing, but it's really genuinely nourishing, to their great surprise.
And what is amrita?
Amrita literally means the nectar of immortality.
Oh, it's a symbolic thing.
It's a symbolic thing, yeah. But it refers to enlightenment. And then finally, in the human realm, this is a begging bowl. So the Buddha in the human realm is dressed as a monk and is suggesting that you go forth. It's suggesting if you're in the human realm, you're in a good state now to actually start to work on yourself and decide, okay, what am I stuck in? Where am I stuck? Where am I over-attached? And can I sort of learn how to start to let go of things a bit? Can I learn how to open my life out in some way? It doesn't necessarily literally mean being a monk or a nun, but it means in some sense that begging bowl represents actually going out and not seeking just security, but sort of seeking the truth. So those are the Buddhas in the realms. Now, for the outer circle here, given that this is another whole lecture, of course, to go through that, but it's the fourth looking in a mirror. So you remember we've looked in the mirror the first time we saw our basic drives, the second time we saw that tendency to polarise, go sloshing over either to being good, being bad, all that kind of stuff. The third time we saw the more complex states we find ourselves in, the six realms. And the fourth time we see the minutiae of the psychological process that keeps our habits going, that keeps us spinning on the wheel. The original idea of the wheel comes from the Buddha's teachings where he says, it's as if we're on an endless round. He uses this word, the endless round. It's as if we're just spinning round, going through the same things all over again. You know, every day we wake up again, and in many ways we just carry on as before. The week looks the same, the year looks the same, even the whole life looks the same. And so what keeps us spinning is this psychological process of the 12 links. And I'm just going to show you them. The first one is ignorance, which is a blind man trying to find his way with a stick, but of course danger lies ahead. And there's the other one. Unfortunately here there's a small boy trying to help the blind man. And the next one is the potter. And the potter is what means karma formations. So this is the way we form our life. So emerging gradually from the ignorance, our habits tend to sort of impel us into a particular kind of life. And this is like a potter making pots and firing them in the kiln. And there's these smaller ones are from this wheel here. So there he is, cheerfully making his pots. Oh, don't know what that was. Next one is a monkey. don't know if I've got a bigger monkey.
Hair on that monkey.
Yes. Oh dear. So the monkey is consciousness, awareness. Having some problems here. After the monkey, because the monkey is constantly grabbing at things, is like that basic interest in the world, I suppose, but in a rather ignorant way. Now we've got a boat with four passengers. The boat is the body. Consciousness is the steerer in the front here, and the other ones are the other skandhas, which is another Buddhist teaching, which I won't go into here. But this is the whole of you. The whole of you as a boat, your mind and your body. And then the next one is a house. And the house normally has a door and five windows. And this is your senses, including the mind. The door of the mind, which lets in your experience, and the five windows of the five senses. So this is your life being formed. And then the next one is a couple making love, sometimes, or just kissing sometimes. And this is contact. So once the senses open, we sort of kiss the world, with any luck. The world impacts on us. We have contact. But then, unfortunately, this gives rise to feelings, which may be pleasant, but they may be unpleasant. And the next one shows the unpleasant feeling. So he's been shot in the eye with an arrow. So it may be pleasant feeling, but it can be unpleasant feeling. And then after the feeling comes craving. And this is, in this case, as if the feeling was pleasant. This is two people getting pissed together. So they're drinking some kind of Tibetan beverage. And so this is, in a way, the image for craving, isn't it? Just, let's have another one. Come on, let's have another one, you know. And then the next one is somebody up a tree picking fruits. but you notice the basket is already full. So this is grasping. Grasping from yet more, always. The tendency to grasping. And then another couple making love. In a tent, this time. This is probably at Glastonbury.
Not a Buddha pit.
Yes. And this is becoming. So this is the process of, this is actually the process of making love in the sense of giving rise to a new being. Giving rise to a new being. Sometimes it's a pregnant woman showing up. And then this is childbirth. So this is birth. not a very anatomically correct. I'm sorry, unfortunately the other pictures I'm showing, I've got another set, but for some reason they're all like this, blank. And here's a wheel of life. Unfortunately I've missed the last one. The last one should have been showing a corpse being carried to the cremation ground. So that's death. So birth, death, and then ignorance again. It just goes round and round through those. I know that's very brief, but there you
what
go.
What did you call those?
They're called the 12 links. The 12 links of conditioned existence. And when you look in the mirror,
gave it another word, though.
It's a psychological...
It's a nidana chain.
The nidana chain, yeah. The minutiae of your psychological life.
The minutiae.
Yeah. In other words, the little details of how one thing leads to another in your own psychology.
It's Jewish term, isn't it, minutiae?
Sorry?
It's Jewish term, isn't it?
No, it just means small things.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is a wheel of life that only shows the hub and the 12 links, which is interesting. And this is, somebody's actually cut them all out, so you can see them again. So the blind man, the potter, the monkey, the boat, only one passenger there, the house, the couple embracing, the arrow in the eye, the two people having a party drinking, plucking fruit from a tree, in this case a pregnant woman rather than two people making love, the lady giving birth, and the corpse being carried to the cremation ground. Round and round and round it goes. Oh, there, yes, there's the corpse being carried, yes.
Being eaten by birds. Mm-hmm.
Yes, because in Tibet they would be actually taken to China ground, where they'd be actually, in fact, sometimes they're actually chopped up and fed to the vultures, which is quite an ecological way of dealing with human bodies.
They're all instincts in a way, aren't they?
In a way they're instinctive, yeah, but they do include decisions that you make. So it's not that we're not responsible for this process. And it's said that the place where we leave it is if after feelings happen, you can leave some space through meditation. You don't go straight into the drinking bout. And the tendency is somebody, you smell the pub and you go in. In this case, you smell the pub, that's the feeling, but you actually say, maybe I won't go. Or maybe you do go in, but you just have an appetizer, a bag of crisps.
Right. You cross the road to the Buddhist centre, don't you?
You cross the road to the Buddhist centre and you become an incredibly quiet religious person.
Yeah. Is there a place that you can actually step off?
Yeah, so that's the spot, is really that little gap there is the best place to leave. So you've been hit by something, you felt it, it's either pleasant or unpleasant, but rather than going the habitual way, that's where your habits step in. You think, oh, that smells nice, I'll go for that. But you actually say, I'll just smell it. I'll just enjoy the smell. But I won't insist on owning it myself. You just torture yourself for a bit, yeah. Or not. Just sit with it, actually, and kiss the joy as it flies, as William Blake says, rather than binding yourself to the joy. So there you go. So that's the whole wheel of life. And at the very top, we've got the Buddha outside the wheel of life. So enlightenment is said to be off this wheel of life. Pointing at the hare in the moon. The hare is the bodhisattva, represents the bodhisattva, because the hare is so unpredictable. And the moon is the coolness of being in a state where you're not spinning around all the time. That sort of state of being much more balanced and equanimous. And so there's a close-up of the Buddha from this wheel of life here. Pointing, sometimes pointing to the wheel maybe, sometimes pointing to the other possibility of the Bodhisattva. And this one, I'll just show you this one that somebody mentioned earlier on, which they call the TARDIS. This shows a path going through the realms, which you can get out of into the Pure Land. This is Amitabha's Pure Land. So it's another approach to spiritual life, which again is the subject of another talk altogether. But it's sort of somebody set down a sort of a rope ladder. So there are ways. And then this is the last one I've got. This is a CD cover from Jar Wobble, which I have a feeling was inspired by the Wheel of Life. And the character in the middle is Mu. And this is the answer to a great koan.
He's also a bit of a student of Blake, wasn't he, Jar Wobble?
Is that right? Interesting, yeah.
was a Kohen, does a dog have Buddha nature?
The Kohen is, does a dog have Buddha nature? And the answer, if you pronounce it correctly, is meow. You get it?
Yes.
So, it is now 8:30, but anyone, any brief questions you want to ask? I'm sorry to give you much space, but you can see it's a big symbol, isn't it? There's so much in there. And you go back to the beginning, remember, what's the purpose of this? In a way, it's just a mnemonic device. It's a way of learning some of these Buddhist teachings. The idea of the basic roots of unskillfulness, which are in there very deep in our nature, the tendency to grab things, push things away, or just ignore things. And then our tendency to be up and down, round and round circles. And then the different states of mind, the different realms. And then the teaching on how this all happens from one mental state to another. And then the teachings of how you get off it, the more positive side of it. Are there any